you are heavy into the true crime community, you've probably heard the theory that there is a killer, or a group of killers, that is targeting college-aged males with athletic builds who were last seen leaving bars or clubs. Their bodies have been found in bodies of water, and there is a theory that a person, or persons, are responsible and is leaving graffitied smiley faces near where the bodies are dumped, or where they are being found. This theory has been dubbed the Smiley Face Killer Theory, and it garnished national attention. Some people believe it is the scare tactic, and others take it as fact. In fact, some even believe the Smiley Face Killer is currently operating out of New Hampshire, as there have been a pattern of bodies being piled from bodies of water. Hello, and welcome to another episode of Dr. Crime, a true crime podcast hosted by me, Justice, a doctor of forensic psychology,
and me, Rebecca, a criminologist.
You won't find clickbait titles, selfie thumbnails, or spooky music to set the mood here. But what you will find is ethical true crime with extra focus on empathy, accuracy, and a viewpoint from professionals.
So grab your coffee and let's get started.
In 1997, New York detectives Anthony Dewart and Kevin Gannon had found suspicious circumstances regarding the death of college student Patrick McNeil. He is found in the East River in Brooklyn, New York. Originally, the case was ruled as alcohol-related accidental drowning. However, the detectives had wanted to look into the case in which the family had approved of. The detectives looked at all the evidence collected and had questioned some of the information. McNeil was found topless, but had pants, socks, and shoes on. It is very unlikely for someone to go swimming in a river in mid-February in a New York winter. There was also question as to why the victim was found face up. Drowning victims are normally found face down, so it was believed that he was placed in the water. There was also ligature marks found around his neck, and there was also fly egg nests in his pubic hair, which the detectives had believed must have been he must have been dead on land before ending up in water, because flies do not lay eggs on deceased human bodies in temperatures under 52 degrees. And of course, this is a New York winter, so it was well below the 52 degrees. There was also charring and blackened skin on Patrick's upper torso and head. This originally was believed to be due to exposed elements, and of course, advanced decomposition. However, this was disputed by the new investigators and believed it was charred from the fire. The investigators believed that McNeil was tied to something and his back was protected from the flames, which is why the charring stopped where it did and explained the ligature marks.
Okay, I mean, I can definitely see where this is sounding a little suspicious and not like a normal drowning.
Oh, completely agree. I see where this would lead investigators into thinking that this was murder, and I think we can all agree on that. It was after this murder that detectives had submerged themselves into this new theory. They looked into a string of cold cases where men, college-aged and last seen at a bar, had been found in a body of water. Of course, this was all throughout most of the eastern part of the United States, literally down like almost an exact half of the United States, and it was on like the eastern part. So it was all up and down the East Coast. It was all like kind of in the Midwest. So through investigating, they had found smiley faces spray-painted near a supposed dump site near 22 of the bodies. I saw a few blogs and articles that cited 4 dozen smiley faces, but when I started really looking into it, it was only a confirmed 22 smiley faces spray-painted. I also want to interject that the detective said that the smiley faces were near where the bodies were dumped, which confuses me. Because when it comes to finding bodies in water, there's no real way to figure out exactly where a body was dumped. There was also some found by where the body was discovered. So kind of inconsistent.
How many bodies were investigated or found total?
Well, throughout the 1990s and 2000s, they believed that 45 were a part of the theory. However, it is now estimated that over 100 victims have fallen to this quote-unquote smiley face killer.
So essentially, the smiley faces, they were only found at 22 of these, like, 45 to over 100 sites, right?
Correct. And in 2008, the detectives had come forward with a theory that an organized group of serial killers would drug unsuspecting victims at a bar or party, then abduct, hold, and torture the victims before finally killing them and dumping their bodies in water. This gained national attention when the investigators came forward, and when they had a loved one that fit like when families had loved ones that fit the profile, they would submit for the case to be looked at. There were a couple cases, like in Minneapolis, the case of Chris Jenkins. He was a 21-year-old college student who went missing and was originally listed as suicide. However, a new police chief took over and had re-examined the case, and the toxicology did show there was GHB in the system. Now, the theory had ramped back up again after that because they had found a body that was listed as a suicide and there was GHB in the system. Especially because the original theory believed that the killers were drugging their victims, so...
Yeah, I can definitely see how that would put some gumption back into their theory.
Definitely. And of course, that is until...
Of course, yep, yeah, there it is.
There it is, yeah. Jeremy Lynn Alford, who was later charged with a different murder, was at the same bar as Christopher the night he went missing. The police had a hunch that he may have been responsible, since he was already in jail for the murder of someone else. They had set up a catfish account where they were pretending to be a woman named Lindsay. Lindsay would ask Alford about Jenkins, and his response was, "I'm not going to talk about anything I am not convicted of." However, there was still some doubt in the people because the person Alford killed was, I believe, was a roommate, and it was a brutal killing. And there were no marks on Jenkins, so it'd be kind of weird to have him kill one person, like, very gruesomely, and kill another not as violently. Jenkins' costume was still in contact because it was around Halloween. There was no bruising, and there was no ligature marks. So some inmates also said that they heard Alford bragging about his death and how he was able to get away with it. But, of course, we've covered on the podcast numerous times, don't trust a jailhouse informant.
Oh my god, see last week's episode.
Right? Some people believe that Jenkins fell in the river, and other people believe it was a friend of Jenkins who went to give him a ride home, killed him and pushed him into the water, or killed him then put him in the water. So there's definitely like a lot of theories around Jenkins, but nothing really concrete.
Did the body have the same charring as McNeil or the ligatures or anything?
No, the only reason the case turned into questionable homicide was because of the GHB found in toxicology.
So there wasn't really anything that connected the two cases other than they were male college-age students that were found in water?
Correct. And I want to mention that many of the deceased family members initially wanted to work with Dewart and Gannon to help determine if their loved ones were murdered or not. I will say a couple family members are still working with the clan, but many of the families stated that there was some sketchiness going on. They felt really violated and exploited and felt that the investigation was severely hurting as opposed to helping. They claimed the investigators were kind of dodgy. They didn't really answer their questions. And one father, who is even used to be a police officer, worked in law enforcement, was very willing and ready to work with the investigators. He stated that the investigators wouldn't even talk to him. A lead investigator on the case suspected to be the Smiley Face Killer had reached out to the detectives multiple times saying, like, I have a case you guys might want to look into. The investigators didn't really reach out back to him, but then used that case as an example of the Smiley Face Killer, but never talked to the lead detective.
That's so weird. I wonder why. Like, if they had this theory, you would think they would take any information and any claims from the family or anything that would potentially help their theory or help prove their theory. That doesn't sit right with me.
Yeah, I mean, like, I understand that some people might be apprehensive over how law enforcement was treating the cases because, you know, we're going to cover later how not many people believed them. But when you have detectives are like, hey, I have a case for you to look into. I want to work with you. Like, can you look into this? Not ask the lead detective anything and then use that case kind of just, I don't know, doesn't sit right with me either.
Yeah.
So, of course, take that with a grain of salt. But even the families believed that the investigators were pulling at straws for the theory and felt kind of uncomfortable. While they were still looking for answers, it really wasn't a heavily favorited theory by officials.
I can see why. It kind of seems like they didn't have a whole lot backing their theory, so I get that. But since the investigators came forward, did they, like, submit this information to the FBI or... anyone? Anything?
Yes. So they submitted the case to the FBI for them to investigate, but the FBI had responded with, quote, To date, we have not developed any evidence to support links between these tragic deaths or any evidence substantiating the theory that these deaths are a work of a serial killer or killers. The vast majority of these instances appear to be alcohol-related drownings.
Interesting that they say vast majority and not all of them.
Right, and that's for a good reason. It's really important to point out here that there were some cases that were looked into after this theory came out and were found to have been homicides or at least suspicious deaths. But we also have to remember that bodies of waters are very common dumping places after killing someone. The FBI wasn't the only entity to not support the theory either. The Center for Homicide Research, which is a well-respected entity and research group, had also released extensive research, including 18 reasons why the smiley face killer isn't too believable. Some of the theories included timeline, that smiley faces are omnipresent, which just means that they're kind of everywhere. So it's a very, very common drawing. Graffiti doesn't really match each other either. There is nothing like the spray paint wasn't the same color, wasn't drawn the same way. So there wasn't really anything like with that either. No criteria had been established specifying the necessary distance that a smiley face must occur in proximity to the deceased body in order to be counted. No evidence of victim trauma. Homicidal drowning is extremely rare, and is almost found exclusively in filicide cases. That's when parents kill their children. The supposition that only males are drowning does not necessarily support a serial killer theory. Now, I do want to take a break and just say that the researchers had said that males are more likely than females to die or be hospitalized from drowning. They also said that alcohol and risky behavior have been known to show up as factors in drowning cases. Now, in La Crosse, Wisconsin, foot patrols and police have stopped over 50 intoxicated persons from 2006 to 2010 from approaching the river late at night. Furthermore, college-age drinkers are typically less experienced drinkers and are more likely to drink and to get drunk and binge drink and kind of become reckless. The process by which intoxicated men accidentally fall into the river is already known and pretty well documented. Many of these drowning cases are likely to involve aspects of auto assassination, which we're going to get to later. It's not necessarily suicide, but we are going to cover that a little bit later. The Center for Homicide Research also noted that malicious drugging of victims is unsupported by evidence. We're going to get to that later as well. Presence of GHB, which is gamma hydroxybutyric acid, in the victims does not indicate whether these victims were maliciously drugged or knowingly administered the substance to themselves. The drowning of the college-age student is not limited by region, but by climate. It happens in the United Kingdom and Canada as well. States such as Arizona, Utah, and Nevada all lack cases due to their absence of water in the desert climate. The deaths in other countries are never linked by nefarious activities, just the accidental behavior of inexperienced and intoxicated youth.
Ooh, it's kind of difficult because I can see where people might think, oh man, all of these bodies are being pulled from this, body of water. So, this is obviously suspicious. This must be a serial killer. But then also, yeah, all of the cases I've heard about personally as an adult have been, people were drunk. They fell out of a canoe. They couldn't swim. It was cold, whatever. So that's definitely interesting. And the FBI and numerous researchers and investigators, from what you're saying, it sounds like they've debunked the theory.
Correct. They have. Now, I know a lot of people are going to hear the evidence and the research and think that researchers have their own agenda and are going to have their own, well, I feel it in my gut. I know something is wrong and I can't stop that. But just every time misinformation is spread around there's a lot of fear mongering when there shouldn't be. And there's so much more to a serial killer than just being found in a common area. Even just like the research said, okay, so we have this big grand group of killers. We'll call them smiley face killers, but they don't really operate in Arizona, Utah, or Nevada, where there's very little, water mass. Just those states don't operate, you know?
Yeah, I do think it's interesting. You know, we're in a unique place because we're both part of this sort of true crime community online, but also both educated in the topics that kind of, you know, influence that. And I just think, I think it is very interesting how often we have heard discussion about serial killers on like TikTok or YouTube or whatever, and everything that is being said is just factually not true. I think it's one of those things where people hear a podcast or watch a documentary and then they sort of get information that is not correct, and then that misinformation spreads like wildfire, and it really influences these trends that we're seeing in social media. A really good topic, we just talked about it, is the human trafficking thing. But it's also happening with like the serial killer community as well.
Exactly. I mean, people think they know how serial killers work, and because they think they know how they work, they think they know more than they do, and accidentally spread misinformation.
Yeah.
And we are led to believe that through shows that serial killers are connected and will leave a pattern, which is true. But there is also a lot that goes behind a serial killer and the psychology of a serial killer. And it's so much more complex than people believe. Just because bodies are being found in a similar place, in a place that can also kill, for the record, it's not like they're being found in a dumpster or they're being found, you know, in the middle of nowhere. They're being found in an element that can kill you automatically.
I think that a lot of the issue, too, is that maybe there's not a really clear understanding of the definition of serial killer. So, you know, a lot of people may not be sure of the difference between mass murderer and serial killer. I'm sure if our listeners are true crime fanatics, which I'm sure they are, they'll know, but a mass murderer is a killer who kills more than four people within the same time frame and at the same location. However, there were a few recent incidences that have researchers maybe trying to change that verbiage to state that a mass murderer could be within a specific radius. So, you know, the killer can go to a second location directly after, and it's still part of the same murder. A serial killer is someone with two or more kills, but they have a cooling off period in between those kills.
And of course, the term cooling off is not well defined either. However, some research has used the definition of a cooling off period as a psychological component where the killer disconnects, separated, or compartmentalizes themselves from the motives that led them to kill and then reintegrate themselves into non-criminal activity.
I think that that's really important to just, you know, note that that cooling off period, yeah, that means that they are removed from the criminal activity. I actually very recently saw a post where people were arguing that Chris Watts was a serial killer because he killed at his home and then traveled to his work site and then committed the other murders. But everything that he was doing was criminal activity. There was no cooling off period. He never took a break psychologically. So what we're saying is essentially a serial killer is anyone who kills two or more people for psychological desire with a cooling off period in between where they sort of return as a normal member of society.
Right, exactly. And like, you know, you can, Aaron Hernandez is an example of someone that like, he wasn't killing for a psychological need. So even if he did kill that third person, he wouldn't necessarily be a serial killer. Because part of that, you know, you have to have the body count and you have to have the cooling off period and you have to have the psychological desire. A serial killer has a psychological desire. So they release that need to kill and then now they're going back into normal society. So that's kind of like where the difference lays in.
Do we know how long that cooling off period may last?
This is another heavily debated topic in the community. Some researchers estimated the cooling off period needs to be after 24 hours. Some state needs to be 48 hours. Some would say it needs to be more than a week apart from their kills. Most consistently, I'm seeing 48 hours because someone may kill multiple people for gratification, but as a string within 24 hours. And that could be a mental illness or psychosis as opposed to fantasized needs. Which brings up the next really important part of understanding the serial killers, fantasy. A large portion of serial killers derive their killing from a form of fantasy. The fantasy type killers make up a large portion of notorious killers, the Bundys, Gacys, Gane, Dahmer. When you think of serial killers, we almost all instinctively think of these, sexual sadists, the fantasy, because there is a sexual component to fantasy killing, and the victim doesn't even have to be sexually touched. The killer may get off on the kill itself or the fantasy they have created with the kill. That's why most serial killers have a past of sexually assaulting someone as well, because there normally is a criminal escalation. You don't just wake up one day, go from good old Samaritan to serial killer. There's like a path. Normally, especially with your fantasy killers, your sexual sadist, they start with voyeurism, escalate to small petty crimes like robbery. They go even further, and then they'll start committing sexual crimes and then escalating to serial killer. So, that's obviously not every single killer out there, because there are many different types of killers, but for the most part, especially like your notorious killers, you're going to find in their history, they started with voyeurism, started with small crimes, they worked themselves up to robbery and or arson. They worked themselves up, they sexually assaulted people, and then they escalated to killing. Now, speaking of different types of killers, there are different typologies. So basically, a typology is kind of like how you can categorize the killers, and then there's different types of typologies. So the first is the Dietz typology. This was considered like the original. They included five types of killers. So they have a psychopathic sexual sadist, and this is where they have the sheer pleasure of torturing and murdering their victims in a sexual way. There doesn't need to be rape for it to be sexual, as long as the killer is getting sexual gratification from it. The second is a crime spree killer, which is where they commit the murders while committing other crimes. Most commonly, it's robbery. They have a thrill from the power and flaunting of authority. Think of like a Bonnie and Clyde where like they would, rob and kill. Number three is organized crime. These are your professional hitmen who kill for money or for no notoriety in their division. So think of like your mobsters and your mafias and stuff like that. Number four is your custodial killer. These are murderers who care for the vulnerable. They are an angel of death, as it's called, where nurses in hospitals or nursing homes will murder their ill or elderly patients, most commonly by asphyxiation and medication overdose. Next is your psychotic killers, and these are most of the time that are under some form of delusion and/or heavy mental illness is present. So that's the Dietz typology, and then there's the Holmes typology, which
Wait,
kind of.
sorry to interrupt. A quick question. The Dietz typology, is that Park Dietz, like the same one who testified
No.
in the Andrea Yates case?
That was my first concern. It's a different person. When I saw that typology, I was like, there's no way. And I looked and it's not. It's just the same last name.
Okay.
Yeah. So next is your Holmes typology. So this is like the Holmes version of the type, so you're going to find similarities. There's a spatial mobility killer. This is just like based off of like geographically like where killers will kill. Then you have the visionary serial killer. This is where victims are typically strangers and they have delusions and hallucinations. This is close to like the psychotic killer. Then we have the mission serial killer, where this is like religious or political imperative to eradicate a certain group of people. We're going to talk a little bit about this later, but it's almost like someone that would kill prostitutes because prostitutes are committing a sin and we don't want sinful people living in the world, like that kind of like mission. Then we have comfort oriented, and this motive contains some of like the utilitarian. This is where there's murder for profit, whether it's a hired assassin or someone kills their family for insurance payout. There is often feelings of hatred and revenge mixed in here. Now, Holmes is one of the older ones, and it was kind of taken out that like someone who kills their family for an insurance payout wouldn't be a serial killer. But just kind of going over that this is like murder for profit. And also this is where like your hatred and revenge comes in. Then we have hedonistic serial killer, and this is where you get sexual pleasure from killing, mutilating, torture, dismemberment. This is domination, necrophilia. This is kind of like what you, again, what you imagine when you think of serial killers. And then you have the power control killer, and this is where there's pleasure from torture and killing another human. More emphasis on power and control than sexual. Though sexual assault is all about power and control, so there can be some markers of sexual gratification, but instead of the gratification being the motive, it's the feeling of power that is more important than getting off. Then we have the Rappaport typology. This is where they have spree killers. This is where killers that they kill their victims during a continuous plan, similar to a crime spree. Then we have the functions of organized criminality, which is your contract killers, your assassins. They have custodial, which is where they take care of the caretakers. They have nurses, foster parents, disabled children. Kind of think of like a twisted altruism as well. Then we have psychotic, which is again under the influence of delusions, and sexual sadistic, which is derived from sexual pleasure. So basically, after all of these typologies came out, they're like, all right, can we have a comprehensive list of what's going on in the psychological, like in the typologies of the serial killer? So based on the commonalities, there's the sexual sadist, which is like they kill for intense pleasure. This is your traditional killer. They have delusional, which is mentally ill or ideological based. Again, it, like either going through a form of psychosis or believing that you're killing to make the world a better place. And then we have custodial killers, which is they murder helpless, independent persons. This is like the nurse that kills their patients trope. And then utilitarian, which is the financial gain in some way for the murder. This is, again, mafia, murder for hire, and stuff like that. So with all of those typologies, that's the type of like serial killers that are out there.
I'm overwhelmed. I think that essentially we can bring this all back into the type of serial killer someone is, that their classifications really all boil down to what motivates them to commit the crime. And
Exactly.
there's lots of different typologies.
Lots of different typologies, lots of different types of typologies. So it's definitely very overwhelming. But overall, you kind of have like the core five of the sexual sadist, the delusional, the custodial, and the utilitarian. So
Right.
four, not five. I apologize. I have a PhD, can't do math apparently. But yeah, before we connect more research to the smiley face killer, I want to mention a really important part of understanding serial killers. And that's organized versus disorganized. An organized killer has the following traits. They're above average IQ. They have well thought out plans. They take care of their appearance and belongings. They have normal relationships. They have fantasy and ritual. Their fantasy and ritual are very important to the organized killer. They will travel many miles to find the perfect victim in perfect circumstance, and they want to steer clear of the area that they're from. They'll likely have a torture kit or have the necessary supplies to commit murder and or mutilation. And they take souvenirs from the murder because, again, this is like a ritual. This is a fantasy. Most of the time when you meet your organized serial killer, you find out who they are and you look into who they are. Most of their friends and family are going to say that they were just a regular person. Dexter is an ex a perfect example of an organized serial killer. Where all his friends and family are like, oh, he's just a regular guy, like he's a nice guy, whatever, but he had his rituals, he had his fantasies, he had his torture kit. So like that's a really good example. Your organized killers will also follow and stalk victims. They'll also normally have alcohol involved, so they'll try and get the other person under the influence or try and like go out for drinks with their victims, stuff like that, which doesn't happen for every organized killer, but it is commonly found. And of course, where you have organized, you have disorganized, which is average or below IQ. They're a loner, they're recluse, they're an underachiever, they're sexually and interpersonally inadequate, they have a poor self-image, engaged in voyeurism, exhibitionism, probably like steal women's panties, they have fetish burglaries. They're less careful about their planning. They're impulsive and spontaneous. They have something called a blitz attack leading to overkill. And so they're less likely to take trophies because they're not as like controlled. When you think of disorganized, you would think of like the creepy guy in a basement where you find out who they are and you're like, oh yeah, no, that guy is 100% a serial killer. Like, so, you know, overall, organized is someone who plans and they're methodical. They have their rituals. They're rarely impulsive. They know what they're doing. They've, you know, they've perfected their kill. They won't make a lot of mistakes. And it's almost like an obsessive compulsive behavior, too, where they can't stop it. I, again, just want to use Dexter as a great example of an organized killer. You know, and they have that need and fantasy to kill.
So when we talk about serial killers, we definitely need to talk about rituals and signatures. A ritual is when a serial killer has a specific process in killing their victim, whether it's one step of the process or it's multiple. The ritual must be complete in order to achieve that satisfaction that they need to feel, you know, finished. If a ritual can't be completed, it can be mentally debilitating to the killer, and it can actually lead to them acting impulsively. Whereas a signature is a personal marking, this is almost like a taunt to the police. Like, this is who I am. You find this a lot in your sexual serial killers. The signature will likely be something important to the offender. So this can mean they take something from the victim. They remove a specific body part. Even something like using a specific dumping site. A very common idea of a souvenir is like a strand of hair from the victim.
Which I think, like, understanding, like, the ritual and the signature is exactly why people think that the smiley face killer exists, why they think there's a serial killer in New Hampshire. And really, across the country, there is a common dumping ground, which, as we just said, could be a signature. But that doesn't always mean it's a serial killer, especially when the dumping ground is a force of nature on it that can kill on its own. And that dumping ground is also a very common type of dumping ground. When we look at the psyche of a serial killer, there is another important aspect of the mind, not just organized and disorganized in the typology, but we also have escalation versus de-escalation. Escalation is when the killer is not becoming fully satisfied quickly enough, and they need to kill closer and closer together. Their kills will increase, as will their behaviors. Their kills are going to be less methodical. A good example of escalation is Jeffrey Dahmer. He started with a good length of time between his kills. He would be satisfied and then, you know, would take a little bit to hunt. He would kind of come off like that high of the kill. And then his kills started becoming quicker and quicker. His hunting became quicker and quicker. He then started to break rituals and would start his hunt for the next victim before he would even complete his last kill. That is escalation. You could see as his crimes continued, he was acting less and less methodical and organized, and he wasn't staying satisfied as long.
And of course, de-escalation is just the opposite. The killer is becoming satisfied with their kills. They aren't needing to hunt as they're, like I mentioned, satisfied. If the kills are getting further apart, that just means they're collecting themselves and feeling satisfied.
Mm-hmm. Which is why a timeline is important with a serial killer, so you can map their escalations or if they're de-escalating. Because if they're escalating, they're going to kill more and more frequently, meaning that they are starting to lose control over themselves and their kills. They will become more impulsive. And if the killer is de-escalating, they are lasting a longer time in between kills, meaning that they are satisfied. You know, they found the perfect victim. They lived out that perfect fantasy. They rode that high long enough so they don't need to go back into the pool so quickly.
I feel like most killers escalate because they're getting what they're craving, but that high that comes from the kill, it just doesn't last as long.
Exactly. the high isn't lasting as long. When you know that first kill, oh, it feels so good. You have that release, you have that sexual gratification, and then you're riding on that high. And of course, you know, even when it comes to something like drugs, you always chase that first high, right? So it's the same thing with serial killers. That's why almost all sexual killers always escalate. It's very rare that a serial killer, particularly ones that are sexual sadists, which is a majority of the killers that we know, will de-escalate because that high isn't lasting as long. You know, if you have a custodial, they can go a long time because they got the money they need, they can pay the rent, they're not worried about it. So that's why like their timeline is a little different.
So with the smiley face killer, not only are the kills happening really on the entire eastern half of the country, but that timeline definitely throws everything off.
Right. Because looking at the kills that people think are related to the smiley face killer, the approximate time of death is all over the place. It would be really frequent, then non-frequent, then kind of consistent, but then not frequent, and then very frequent. Which would mean that they can calm themselves after escalating. And when you're in that frame of mind, it's nearly impossible to come back down. Again, that's like asking someone who's addicted to drugs to just stop cold turkey and be fine for a little bit, and then pick back up and use it every single day and every single day, and then just stop cold turkey. So to be able to do it multiple times, that psychologically is nearly impossible.
I'm sure we've all been thinking of this part of the theory, but if the kills were so sporadic and all over the country, wouldn't it nearly need to be a group effort versus just one person? Are there groups of serial killers? Could this be like an evolved type of killer that we still need to learn more about, like that would break every stereotype we know about killers?
Part of the theory was that it was a group of people. Gannon and Dewar originally believed it was a group of people that would communicate on the dark web. We'll get to that in a second. But as for an evolved killer, I mean, it always could be because we don't know what we don't know. But based on even surface level information, I wouldn't believe that they could pull something like this off, because it's there's too much everywhere, but also not enough, and it just wouldn't make sense. Like, for that evolved like type serial killer, it wouldn't really make a lot of sense. A group is really the only thing that would explain everything, but yeah.
I'm sure you're going to tell us more about the group, but I just want to say we should have an entire episode based on misinformation about the dark web. I really
Yeah.
feel like people saw some documentary or something one time where people were like, "Oh my God, the dark web." And now it's really misunderstood.
Oh yeah, it is. I don't know. I don't know. I don't think that serial killers are communicating on the dark web on who their next victim is going to be.
No, I don't think so either.
And as for groups don't work out well. Let's take a second to think about this. There is a reason that we all hated group projects in school, right? Like, even going through my PhD, I thought as an adult working with other adults on a group project would be fine. We're adults, right? I was
Absolutely
wrong.
not.
It was awful. I had to do two group projects and never again. Never again. at least in school. But when you come to groups, think of like the dichotomy of how a group works. You have a leader and you have people that are there just to be there. And then you have people that are following along for the cause, right? Like a couple weeks ago, we did an episode on domestic terrorism. We talked about how in like groups for domestic terrorism, you have the leader, you have the person that's just kind of like the muscle, and then you have the people that are like diehard believers of the cause. It would be something very similar to this, except we also have to think that for every group, there is a weakest link. So you mean to tell me that there is a group of, let's say, at least four people, if not more, you mean to tell me that four of them all have killed flawlessly, didn't get caught for 20 years, and then hasn't said a single word to anybody?
Out of curiosity, was there a theory that maybe they didn't get caught because they were law enforcement officers?
There were some suspicion. And I mean, if you alter the cases and kind of see what you want to see in a pattern, there could be a profile in which the killer is law enforcement or military, as it seems like this person could kill without showing any trauma. So they'd have to know how the body works and how to kill without showing, which is something that you learn in the law, you know, law enforcement and military. So it would also be someone who would move around at extreme rates because of how just all over the country it is. And we both know that can happen in the military. You know, I believe it would be someone who is questioning their sexuality while presenting as homophobic. Again, that sexual sadism. So, like, it definitely could make sense when, you know, a few years ago, I did think that there was something suspicious going on. And I won't lie about that. If you scroll back on my TikTok, I do a TikTok. I'm like, is there a serial killer in New Hampshire? Because, again, there is that signature. There is that ritual. I definitely understand where people are coming from. I don't want to sit here and, you know, say, like, it doesn't make any sense. You're stupid for believing that, because you're not, especially as true crime fanatics. But the hard part of that profile and what I made up and what I was kind of like talking to people about, and now that I'm, you know, it's been a little bit and I've done a lot of research and I've really looked into this, I've talked with, you know, professionals, is that this profile is the mock-up of a fantasy scenario. There are women being pulled from the river as well. There are people of all ages being pulled from the river as well. So it's kind of like you have this entire pool of, let's say, 200 people, but yet the investigators are only focusing on the middle-aged white men that are coming out.
I kind of feel like with all of the information, I can see why researchers and professionals would be kind of on the side, like that there isn't much to the cases. I mean, yes, there were cases that were investigated and found evidence of foul play, but even then, that was only a couple of them, and they clearly weren't connected. One had a ligature mark and fire charring. The other still had a Halloween costume on. Not to mention, the investigators said that they found smiley faces spray-painted near the dumping site, but we wouldn't even know the dumping site. Some were found where the body was found. Like, how would the serial killer even know where the body would eventually be found?
And that's my thoughts exactly. And of course, a smiley face would be a signature. It would be taunting the police. And just think of like how eerie it is, like you kill someone and you paint like a little smiley face. That sends a message. I'm not saying it doesn't. And the body being found in water makes sense as a ritual. But if it was all connected, they would have similar marks and similar trauma. You know, and as from someone from New Hampshire, the entire big list of people pulled from the water that have almost nothing in common. The timelines don't make sense for escalation and de-escalation. They were found all over the states in all forms. They were all ages, races, genders, and other demographics. There was, you know, I talked with some people that had loved ones that are kind of being lumped into this, and they were like, I don't really think that they were a victim of that, but this does interest me. There was someone that was added on the list that was a witness suicide. There was someone on the list that was the family, like, pretty much knows their husband had killed this person, but they're too afraid to say anything because they don't make any accusations. So, like, the timeline for that killer just doesn't really make any sense. And it would be listed as a sexual killing because in reality, the other types wouldn't make sense. It wouldn't make sense for custodial. It wouldn't make sense for, you know, a psychosis, because eventually that would end, or there would, that a someone who's in psychosis is going to be a disorganized killer because they're not going to be as methodical. So really, like, it just doesn't make a lot of sense with all the typologies, organized and disorganized, the escalation and de-escalation, even just skimming the surface of serial killers doesn't really make a lot of sense to me.
I know that the FBI estimates that there's like around 4,000 active serial killers. So, I mean, statistically, there's, you know, a decent chance that one of them is in New Hampshire.
And that is very true, because whenever I talk to someone about this, they're like, but if there's 4,000 active serial killers and there's 50 states, like, chances are, and like, which is very true. But we have to remember, not every serial killer is going to act like the ones we know information about. So there most certainly could be. I even thought that maybe the killer is against drugs and alcohol, because some of the people missing had issues with drugs and alcohol and were part of the homeless camp along the Merrimack Banks. And then But that would place them more as delusional, like I was just saying, which would mean they're disorganized. So again, that doesn't fit the profile. I did think maybe if there was a killer, it would be someone with sexual fantasies and kind of can't come to their terms of sexuality, especially being in the military. I'm sure you can attest there's a lot of homophobia in the military.
Oh, yeah.
So then it would go into sexual sadism. So then that would be organized, which would make sense. But then organized, if they're escalating and de-escalating like that, they're going to show it. They're going to show it in their work. So, but I'm just not seeing consistency enough, because it's not just people that have drugs and alcohol problems, and it's not just men. There are women, children, seniors, all type of demographics, which again, aren't consistent with serial killer behavior. You know, finding an 11-year-old girl's body in the water and then finding a 72-year-old man who had Alzheimer's and was missing for a week in a pond up north, which is so incredibly sad and so tragic, but that doesn't make them all related.
I think that so far that's kind of been the biggest factor for me to, you know, question the theory is, you know, for our listeners, think about the big serial killers that everyone talks about all the time, right? You have Dahmer, who was specifically targeting young men of color. You know, Ted Bundy had the brunette young women in their, you know, early 20s, late teens. We have John Wayne Gacy with the young boys. Like, it's just serial killers usually have a specific demographic that they go after. So for it to just be kind of everywhere, anyone, you know, it just, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think they're connected.
I personally don't either. You know, and that's not to say that some of these people weren't killed. They absolutely could have been. You know, look at McNeil. Clearly that makes sense. But that doesn't mean that it's related to all of the other bodies. You know what I mean? So just looking at all the information, I can't say that the bodies being found are connected. There are people that were murdered, but unfortunately to say, sometimes people murder other people and dump their body. That does not mean that they are related. You have to look at how the serial killer would operate and the facts of this case.
I also don't really think that the smiley face itself is a whole... like, it gives us a whole lot to go off of. It's kind of like you mentioned earlier. People could spray paint smiley faces anywhere for any reason. And the fact that they weren't the same color, they weren't done in the same way. And the investigators, like, they should have been able to tell if they were old or if they were from a different time period. Like,
mm-hmm.
It's just not real solid evidence.
And if a signature, if a serial killer was leaving a smiley face signature, they would want to make it known it was connected, because a serial killer desires being caught, especially your sexual sadistic. They crave on that high and that power, and then they want to become famous for their work. They want to attach their name to their work. So by having different smiley faces, that's also really inconsistent with how a serial killer would think, because again, the serial killer wants to be caught. So they would sit there and then they would, you know, do the same exact smiley face so that they can have consistency and tell the police, like, hey, it's me. I'm here. This is my work. Come find me. Now, of course, this is just skimming the surface on serial killer psychology. As we go through episodes, you know, if there's another season, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, I want to have specific cases for specific information, because there's just so much. This episode would be 5 hours long if we had to go in depth over absolutely everything. But when talking about the smiley face killer theory, it's really important to understand the research behind it. You know, the Center for Homicide Research had conducted very lengthy investigations and research into how it could be possible. They didn't have their own agenda. They wanted to help. They wanted to present the case to the FBI if they found enough information, but they didn't. You know, like I was saying earlier, the official research found 18 reasons as to why the smiley face killer theory is not sustainable. That's not two reasons that can eventually be figured out. That's 18. These aren't departments with an agenda. It's scholarly research, and they have had over a dozen researchers that look into this case. They found generic things like the timeline not adding up and how there's a lack of trauma on nearly everybody on the case. Another factor that made them question things is we don't know how GHB got into the select male's drinks, and only a few of the cases studied actually had GHB. But, and hear me out here, the researchers stated that we don't know if the GHB was given to them by a stranger or if they administered it to themselves on accident. And this is not victim blaming. Please just hear me out on this. We know college-aged men can do some not so great things, especially to other people's drinks. Did they drug the wrong drink? Did they take a sip of their intended victim's drinks? We don't even know if that the drink that they took was intended for someone else and they were just an innocent third party that's like, oh, hey, I think this is my drink and it's not, and they ended up getting the drug. So that was just something the researchers couldn't prove was how is it administered, and it was found in so few of the bodies. And because we know how high of a rate the GHB can be found at parties, kind of made them question. And also the researchers had noted that the demographic was very common as to something called self-assassination, which isn't suicide per se, but rather reckless behavior that results in their death.
I have thoughts on GHB specifically. So, GHB, while yes, like it is often used as sort of like a date rape drug, it's also like a party drug, like a rave specific party drug. It's known as liquid ecstasy. So people do take it themselves intentionally, to get high. It causes, euphoric high, it causes hallucinations. It's a party drug. So the thing is also if you take it and then you especially drink alcohol, which people would be doing if they were at a party, right? Maybe. It can cause you to have vision changes. It can cause you to become unconscious. It can cause you to be, nauseous or drowsy or dizzy. So I almost wonder, especially if we're talking about young college-aged men, if people were just at a party and like took it too far.
Which is definitely very possible because in the research, they actually kind of address that. There is a quote that says, "The process by which intoxicated men accidentally fall into the river is already known and well documented. The La Crosse Police Department issued a report detailing the circumstances of at least 20 imminent drowning victims who survived using firsthand accounts. The causes were included dares, suicide attempts, and most commonly, accidents. Eyewitnesses were present for several of these instances. Most of all victims were intoxicated at the time of near drowning, and intoxicated victims can and do fall into the river. Contrary to popular belief, accidental drownings are fairly common. They are not typically well documented. Footwear slip marks have been documented on the riverbanks of Minneapolis by the Center for Homicide Research Department, end quote.
Interestingly, when I was stationed in Florida, I lived in this apartment complex. It had like a retention pond in it. And there was this whole incident where there was a few people that were out on the pond in canoes, and they were very drunk, and these were like young active duty men. So they were, physically fit and everything. They were just intoxicated, but their canoe like capsized and they drowned in the retention pond. And it took them like 3 or 4 days to find them, even though they knew exactly what had happened and everything. It just see I think it might be more common than people think, accidental drownings.
Especially when you have the Merrimack River, which is a river that runs through quite a bit of New England. It has very high currents. It is a very commonplace for fishing. And of course, if you're from the New England area, you know that along, especially like cities like Manchester, New Hampshire, Lowell, Mass, Dracut, Lawrence, Mass, like where the river runs through, that a lot of homeless people live along the banks too, and that's where they'll like do drugs. So There have been a few cases where someone would OD and the other people in the encampment would not know what to do with the body. And of course, they don't want to call the police because there's drugs and they're not really supposed to be there. So they would just roll the body into the river. So I know that if you're in the camp of there being a serial killer in New Hampshire or believe in the smiley face killer, that I'm not going to change your mind. You're going to listen to this and you're going to be like, yeah, but I hope that at least gaining a new perspective on how serial killers work, you can at least look at the situation critically. You can look at it differently. You can hear this information and say, okay, but I hear what you're saying, but what about this? And I understand why you do that. There is just so much more to a serial killer than you see on TV or in media. And there are people that they are real people that are complex, and it's not as simple as connecting through where bodies died. Bodies of waters can kill just like humans can. And even when humans do kill, they are most likely to dispose of bodies in water. According to research, that is the most common place to dump a body when they kill, whether it's an accident or they wanted to get rid of them, whatever violence, whatever reason for the violence. Because most people believe that if the body is in water, it can't be found, it's going to travel, it'll drown, the fish are going to eat it. And believed to wash away evidence. But that doesn't mean that they're late. There certainly can be cases where there is, suspicious activity. It is a homicide, but that doesn't mean that they're all homicide and they're all connected to the same person. And again, I know that these are just some brief info, but even without scratching the surface, I personally don't see the connection to any of them. As a doctor of forensic psychology, the psychology doesn't make sense, the victimology doesn't make sense. That doesn't mean that as new information becomes available, I'm not going to change my mind. I know how frustrating it is that people feel like they aren't getting answers and they just want to know why are so many people dying right now. We also have to remember that suicide happens. We just came out of a pandemic that financially destroyed so many people. Lockdown created so much havoc on people. But as of right now, I really don't think that there are answers to give, and I don't see a connection.
Yeah, I actually didn't know much about the smiley face killer theory until speaking with you about it, but I just don't think so either. I think knowing what research has shown about serial killers, I just don't think it fits. I think it's sad, of course, but it's most likely like accident or just one-off homicides, unfortunately.
Yeah, between the FBI and I know a lot of people are like, oh, the FBI doesn't care. They do care. The FBI does care. And if there was something like this, they would absolutely be in on it.
I agree. I agree. Well, friends, that concludes our episode today. For more information, check out our bio and make sure to follow us on Instagram and Twitter at Dr. Crime Pod. Be sure to let us know your thoughts. We can't wait to talk to you guys next week.